Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to a special episode of The Love Journey. I'm excited to be here today. I am Janie Ann Ingram, your host for tonight. And we're going to have a special guest tonight talking about profile soldiers. And we're going to be talking about some things that are riveting when it comes to veterans. Homelessness. Do you know how many homeless veterans are African Americans? Wow. Did you know that there's a big population of suicide that's happening? I'm sure you didn't. We're going to find out more tonight as we move through this process. And if there's a homeless veteran that you know, if there's anybody that you think should know about this conversation tonight, I want you to invite them right now. Send them a text and let them know that this is information they should know right now. Can you imagine these things are happening right under our eyes and we don't even see it? Unseen things. And so I'm excited tonight to bring this guest tonight. He's a brilliant mind, a gift to the planet. And so while you are inviting a guest, I'm going to play this song, and then we're going to come right in to this amazing gift that God has brought to this planet to bring this awareness. And I love the opportunity. I love this platform to bring ordinary people who are bringing extraordinary things in life. And you're going to hear it for the first time right here on the Love Journey.
Oh,
right, that was Mesa. Can We Change the World? Welcome to another episode of The Love Journey. This is a special episode tonight, and we're going to be talking about veterans' homelessness, what's happening in the world with veterans, and we're going to be talking to Theodore Sweet. So I want you to put your hands together as I read his bio. I am excited to bring him to this platform to talk about this subject. And let me tell you, before I met him, I didn't have this awareness. I knew there was some things going on, but I didn't have the awareness I have. So let me read his bio. His name is Theodore J. Sweet, also known as Teddy. He's a lawyer, veterans advocate who specializes in helping displaced military veterans obtain their veterans benefits. Teddy was born in Tallahassee, Florida. Teddy comes from a military family where his father served 30 years in the United States Army. And his parents have been married over 61 years. Wow. Teddy grew up on various military bases in the United States in addition to living 3 years in Panama. After graduating from high school, Teddy enlisted in the United States Army and served 9 years. After completing his military tour, Teddy utilized his GI Bill to attend New Mexico State University, where he obtained a Bachelor's of Criminal Justice degree. Upon graduating from New Mexico State University, Teddy attended Vermont Law School, graduating with a Juris Doctorate degree. After graduating from law school, Teddy moved to Washington, D.C. and has lived there ever since. Teddy's first job out of law school was a judicial law clerk to two senior judges. Teddy has worked in the United States Postal Service Corporate Law Office, the D.C. Chamber of Commerce, and the District of Columbia Government. During one of his stints in the D.C. government, Teddy served on the cabinet of the mayor of Washington, D.C. as the director of the Office on Ex-Offender Affairs. While serving as director, Teddy was awarded a national best practice by the United States Conference of Mayors in 2009 for creating a resource locator for returning citizens. Utilizing his knowledge of working with displaced populations, Teddy created Profile Soldier. Profile Soldier is a nonprofit whose main two missions is to prevent veteran suicide and inform homeless veterans about their veteran benefits. In July of 2023, Teddy is about to embark on a 22-city tour of the United States where he will connect with and inform homeless veterans of their veteran benefits with the primary goal of bettering their standard of living and suicide prevention. I want you to put your hands together as we meet and hear this great mind, wonderful gift to the planet. Teddy, are you ready?
Thank you for that introduction. I'm honored. I don't know if I can follow it.
I'm sure you can. I mean, man, you, with all the accolades, wow. Let's start, Teddy. Let's start off with who is Teddy and how did you start in your childhood? Let's start about your childhood. Let's talk about that.
Well, as you had stated earlier, I'm a military brat, meaning that my father was in the military. So I was born in Tallahassee, Florida. But from the age of 1 through 17, I moved, you know, throughout the country, continental United States, as we call it, CONUS, Panama. And I ended up graduating from New York. And funny thing about my 12th grade year, I was actually in Fort Benning, Georgia, Columbus, Georgia. In the middle of my senior year, my father got orders to go to Syracuse, New York, so we had to up and leave, and I ended up graduating with a bunch of people that I didn't know. But that's kind of like the life of a military brat. And after high school, I ended up enlisting in the United States Army. And the reason for that is, and a lot of military brats would tell you, we don't want to have nothing to do with the military because we lived the military, you know, in our childhood. But I didn't want to burden my parents with, you know, the bills of going to college. So I ended up enlisting in the military initially 2 years, but I ended up serving 9. It was Turkey, Greece, Italy, New Mexico, Fort Drum, New York, and I really like my tour.
You really like your tour? Hello?
Yes.
Okay. So why did you end up joining the military yourself?
Well, as I was saying before, I didn't want to burden my parents with, you know, the cost of going to college, and I definitely wanted to go, you know, So joining the military was something that, in a way, came natural, because things like polishing your boots, ironing your uniform, even calling cadence when you're marching troops, I had already had exposure to all of that. So I was one of those real squared away troops. And something I'm going to be elaborating on a little later is that I was taught not to complain. And that's very, very, very important, because the word profile soldier is a play on words. If you're on profile, that means you're hurt and you can't perform your duties as a normal soldier would. You know, if we got any veterans listening, I know they're smiling, because they're probably wondering why I named my business Profile Soldier. But the reason for that is that it's kind of like a paradox when it comes to getting your benefits once you become a veteran after being active duty. In other words, when you're a veteran, in order for you to get paid or compensated for an injury, you have to show that in your service treatment records that you were hurt, that you went on profile and so forth. Or like, let's say a hurt leg, a hurt back, a hurt arm, shoulder, whatever it could be. But you're also taught not to complain. So that's where it becomes kind of like a Hobson's choice. You know, if you complain, you're not going to get promoted. But if you complain, you're going to get treated. But at the same point in time, you'll be labeled a profile soldier. And that's going to hurt you when you're in the military, because you're not going to be able to go TDY, temporary duty assignments. You're not going to be able to go to schools like Airborne School or Ranger School. You're not going to be able to go on leave. You're not going to get promoted, and so on and so forth. But when you get out, if you do have these documents, your compensation process would be a lot easier, because you can verify that you actually were under stressful conditions in the military, as we all were, and you actually were hurt. Because a lot of times they don't give you the benefit of the doubt, unfortunately, by just saying that you were hurt. You have to prove it.
Oh, wow. So how did you like being in the military?
I loved it. My job in the military was logistics. Otherwise, I was a supply sergeant. So I was kind of like the lifeblood of the military. Anything from toilet paper to a UH-1 helicopter, I've ordered all of that, you know, in furtherance of our duties and so forth. But another part of my job, which basically left me with a disability, was I was a unit armorer. And basically that I'm the weapons expert for the unit. I'm the one that opens up the arms room. I can walk around with a key ring, almost like a janitor. But that key ring will have, it opens up a vault. And inside that vault, I have arms racks where M16A1 rifles are located. Now I believe they do M16A2s and other long rifles, as we like to call it. And 9mm. They used to have 45s when I was in, but we went to the 9mm Glocks. But I was basically the custodian of all those weapons. And what ended up happening to me, and what I got my disability of claustrophobia, and I want to elaborate on that a little later. But I will say this: some disabilities you can't see. And part of Profile Soldier is addressing the mental health issues that a lot of us veterans have when we come out. It's an unseen injury. you know, much like someone with a prosthetic.
So what did you do after the military?
After the military, after my ETS, I got out with an honorable discharge. I went straight into college. You know, I went utilizing GI Bill. I went to New Mexico State and got my degree in criminal justice. But I'm going to tell you a funny story. In reference to, you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. When I got out, I was the first one in my family to matriculate and get a college degree of any kind, but I was actually getting an associate's degree of paralegal studies, and I remember, you know, telling a lady that back in the day before we had, you know, right on the verge of computers, we would pay people to type papers, and this was like 1995 through 99. And during one of my visits to this lady, she was a paralegal. She said, "Why don't you go to law school? You're young enough." Because what I was planning on doing was I was going to get a associate's degree in paralegal studies, then an associate's degree in sociology, then an associate's degree in criminal justice. And she said, "Honey, you're going sideways. You need to go vertical. You need to take your butt down to the main campus." And so, you know, I didn't know. I thought having three associate degrees was going to put me in a better situation than having a bachelor's degree. And so when people sit there and say they don't know, I can understand that, because being ignorant of something doesn't make you dumb or stupid. It just means you just don't know what you don't know.
So when you went to D.C., how did that affect your process and where you are now in terms of your business profile and everything?
Well, D.C., that was after law school. I went from New Mexico State, then I went to Vermont Law School. And in law school, I actually had that's kind of like where my anxiety disorder manifested. I would always get this little rash of some sort, and I would take antihistamine to get rid of it. I was taking so many of them that they didn't even make me sleepy anymore. And basically how I got rid of that particular condition was, my mom's a devout Christian. She prayed with me over the phone, and I want to touch on Christianity because that's a big part of my life too. I'm a devout Christian. I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe he's saved. He can save us and die for our sins, and so that we can have eternal life, if we so to take it, by living our lives in a admirable, fruitful Christian type way. So once I got rid of the little rash problem, anxiety problem, you know, I ended up graduating, and I graduated law school, and I went to Washington D.C. But I'm going to backtrack. I graduated in 2002, but in 2001, I was actually an intern, and that's how I got my job. I was interning what we call a semester in practice as a 3L. That means my third year of law school. I arrived in Washington, D.C. on September 4th, 2001, and September 11th happened 3 days later. And afterwards, you know, after that, from September to December 2001, my judge offered me a clerkship, which is, you know, pretty prestigious, if I may say so. And that's how I ended up in Washington, D.C.
So how did your position as director of ex-offender prepare you for what you call profile soldier today?
Okay, well, I had a couple positions before that. After my clerkship, I worked for the U.S. Postal Service Corporate Law Division. Then I worked in the D.C. Chamber of Commerce. I was actually their first HR director. And I ended up becoming ex-offender affairs director because a buddy of mine stepped down abruptly, because I was the deputy director first. And so then I became the actual director of that particular office. And that was from the period of 2008 to 2010. and I was awarded a best practice due to the fact I created this resource locator. And I want to touch on that a little bit. The resource locator, I had a giant map in my office, and anytime any of the individuals that would come to my office for services, I would tell my assistant to tell them to come into my office, and I would ask them, where did they go for housing? Where did they go to get a free meal? Where did they go to get a shower? Where did they go to get a metro voucher? Where did they go for shelter in general? And these were coming from firsthand accounts of individuals that at the time were called ex-offenders, but I call them citizens, but I think the proper term, politically correct term now, is returning citizens, meaning that anybody that came in my office had the bracelets on them on their wrists at one point in time and was incarcerated for a period of time, whether a couple of days or years. So it was a job that basically I loved, because everybody deserves a second chance, and you can see the redeeming qualities in individuals who have been away for a while. You should never turn your back on your fellow man.
Oh, wow. And that's called the Mapping Project?
Yeah, it was a mapping project, 2009, the U.S. Conference of Mayors. They ended up giving me a best practice for that. I could not take the actual project with me, you know, when I left the government, because as an attorney, I found out that the code is what is actionable, and that's what's copywritten. And the code was written by some individuals that were detailed to me from the OCTO office, Office of Chief Technology Office. There was a geospatial analyst. So my locator was actually GPS driven, and you would press a button, you would basically say clothing or schools or shelter or food or whatever resource you needed, you could type it in and it would populate, you know, the various places in D.C. in which you could access the services. So I felt really proud about that. Now everybody has resource locators, and that's part of what I'll probably get into later, Project 22, in reference to trying to eradicate veteran suicide.
Wow. Did you know that was going to be my next question? I was going to ask you about the 22 veterans that commit suicide every day. So since we opened the door, can we talk more about that, or did you want to expound on something else before we go into that?
No, I want to I talk about it, but I'm going to tell you about, I actually encountered one of my soldiers actually attempted suicide while I was stationed in Vicenza, Italy. I didn't even realize that, you know, he was having those kind of issues, but he was caught walking at night, you know, on post, and he had a letter in his pocket basically saying that, you know, basically a letter saying goodbye, tantamount to a last will and testament, and he was going to saying he was going to take his own life, but the military police was able to apprehend him. I don't want to say apprehend him like he was in commission of a crime, but he was just walking around very, very disoriented, and they ended up putting him in a hospital in what we call on suicide watch. And of course, as being in his chain of command, they called me up and talked to me about it, you know, and so that was my first exposure to someone attempting suicide. And I can just tell you this, one of the things that, you know, I always do when I talk to anybody, I say, hey, how's it going? You know, everything all right? And I think that's a very it's a very re- is a very caring thing to ask someone, but it also can reveal something that you might be able to help someone who's having some difficulty, because not everybody is going to have a psychologist or psychiatrist around. And I just want to, that's one thing I want to stress now, is that we need to take care of each other. You know, a lot of us could be counselors to each other, much like individuals that go to a mental health practitioner.
You talked about this a little bit earlier, how soldiers are not to complain. They feel like no one cares. Sometimes they even end up homeless. Do you think that the fact that soldiers are taught not to complain and that they have to internalize it and not really express it is part of the suicide process? Or what's your thoughts about that?
See, here's the thing, and I'm going to be referring to the 2022 Department of Veterans Affairs annual report on suicide. And one of the takeaways, if you read that 43-page report, is that a lot of soldiers, not soldiers, well, former soldiers, veterans that are suicidal, attempt suicide, and they know this just from various interviews, that's individuals who try and aren't successful in suicide. They talk to them. The individuals that are successful, notes might be left around and things of that nature, you know, telling people that they plan on, terminating their existence. Most of these soldiers, about 70% of them, aren't connected to VA. And let me touch on that. That means that they're not connected to VA in any way, shape, or form. And I'm going to tell you one of the reasons why I think this is so. When you get out of the military, you lived a very disciplined life. There's a lot of things you can and cannot do. You can't smoke marijuana, of course. You can't have hair on your face. You can't let your hair grow long and things of this nature. You gotta dress a certain way even when you're off duty. So when we call ourselves short timers, that means individuals that are going to be exiting the military, they will end up, you know, wearing facial hair, growing their hair long. They'll do all the things that basically make them, i.e., a civilian. And one of the things they do also is they want to get rid of their uniforms, and they don't want to have any kind of association with the military. And unbeknownst to them, you know, there's no rank structure once you become a veteran. You know, all veterans are ranked equally from an E1 to an O10, which is a four-star general. So a lot of times when a soldier gets out the military, they terminate all connections with the military or veterans department in general. And they just go and live their existence, not knowing that there's many, 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 many benefits that are afforded to them other than just having someone say thank you for your service.
Wow. You know, I was reading the Pink Inn, and they said there's a big homeless problem with veterans. And they said in this particular article I read, 56% of homeless veterans were African American. Do you think there's a homeless problem with veterans?
I don't think. I know there's a homeless problem with veterans, and it should not, and that should not be the case. They got a situation called the HUD-VASH voucher, and that's basically if you are systemically homeless, that means you've been homeless once, twice, three times, you'll get this voucher. But I think a way to alleviate it is to give most veterans, mainly all veterans, when they get out, you know, some form of assistance if needed to go ahead and settle down in an apartment and so forth. Because what they do is they give veterans what we call the VA Home Loan Certificate Program. So if anybody's a real estate agent or a realtor and whatnot, you probably know that veterans can buy homes with no money down, no closing, and if they maintain a certain credit score, they can go ahead and they can buy their house. But sometimes a veteran's not ready for a house. Sometimes they need to get an apartment. Sometimes they need a studio. Sometimes they need something lesser than. But what the VA has done, and it's a good thing with the home loan certificate program, but I think they need to be more aggressive with the intermediary placement of veterans. So that they, so that they will not end up, you know, in this kind of like situation. Let me touch on something real quick, and you know, I could say this because I'm not indebted to the VA or anybody, so you know, I can speak my mind on this. When you join the military, you go through this process called MEPS, Military Processing Station, and they will check you out like a used car. You notice I say used car, not a new car. A used car, they really got to check out because of lemon laws and so forth. So they know everything. The dealer knows everything that's wrong with that car when that car leaves the lot. And that's how the veterans are when they come into the military. When they leave the military, when they do what they call it, when we do our ETS physical, the ETS physical, what they do, they will ask you if there's anything wrong. A lot of times you're going to say no, there's nothing wrong, because you don't want to hold up your exiting the military, and that very statement will be used against you, because later on when you get out, they'll say, oh, you said there was nothing wrong with your feet, but in your exit interview, even though you may have had went to sick call 10 times or more important than that, where the profile soldier comes in, you complained about it, but you didn't complain about it to the point where you had to go to the doctor and get a profile because you wanted to stay on the promotion board. You wanted to go to air assault school, Pathfinder school, air assault school. So what I'm trying to say basically is that with all the paperwork and with all the indoctrination and the doctrine, there's actually a doctrine command called TRADOC, which deals with our training. They know pretty much the level of condition physically and mentally most soldiers are in. But what happened is when you exit the military, in order to get your benefits in law, you got to do what we call purposely avail yourself. You got to file for benefits. It's not automatic. And I think that at some point in time, you know, it needs to be automatic, because sometimes the veteran is getting out of the military in a mental condition in which is different from the condition in which he entered the military. So he gave of himself to the point where he's, you know, mentally in a different condition, and that condition is solely because of his military service, and he should be compensated for that.
So how would profile soldiers assist displaced veterans and veterans who may need a helping hand? How would profile soldiers be a resource for them?
What I plan on doing, when I looked at the VA's 2022 report on veterans homelessness and suicide and mental health issues, the one thing that was striking is that they were concerned about individuals who came to the VA. That means you had to walk inside of a Department of Veterans Affairs facility, whether it's a regional office, whether it is a hospital, whether it's a clinic, and tell them that you wanted services. But me using the Christian faith modality or framework, a lot of times you have to do a ministry called outreach. In other words, you just can't wait for someone to come through your doors. You got to go out and you got to touch people where they are. And I think that's what I plan on doing with Profile Soldier. I'm going to do what we call a patrol reconnaissance. I'm going to go and find soldiers where they are. A lot of people may not know this, but a lot of homeless people and displaced people, they will go to places like the library. Library is almost a haven for people, because You can read books, but at the same point in time, it's like the only place that you can go to and use the restroom as a homeless person without having to be told, are you buying something, or, you know, are you a patron here? You know, it's one of the few places where you can go sit down and be treated humanely. So I've been, you know, as I've been formulating some of my strategies, I've been going to the Martin Luther King Jr. Library here in D.C., and I just sit down and I see, you know, certain things. You kind of can spot a homeless person. Sometimes the person might be carrying one too many bags, you know, or and so forth. And sometimes there are other ways in which you can, you know, you can detect these individuals, but you got to have a heart for people like that. Sometimes those people are ostracized, and that's why I say that when I was the ex-offender affairs director, a lot of those individuals that came into my office, they had committed crimes before, you know, against someone else at one point in time, and a lot of people felt that they didn't deserve a second chance. They felt that they should, they got what they deserved, and, you know, they thought that they would be a word we use in Christianity called reprobate, you know, where God's not going to bless you anymore. But only, you know, there's few ways where you can become reprobate, and I don't think these individuals are. But what I will do in Profile Soldier, I plan on going to 22 cities and try to enlist about 50 veterans and tell them about their benefits, which they may not even know about. Another thing I plan on doing is giving them a cell phone, because with WhatsApp, you can actually don't even have to have a plan. All you got to do is be around Wi-Fi, and you will be able to go ahead and you can call someone. Because a lot of times when an individual is going to commit suicide, this comes from psychological and psychiatric reports and so forth, they will try to make an attempt to call someone. But something happened in society that a lot of people cannot understand this, but when I say it, just think about it. A lot of times I used to be an assistant teacher for my judge at UDC and Howard University here in Washington, D.C., and sometimes I would ask them to do a scavenger hunt, and part of the scavenger hunt I would say, I want someone to call me, and I put my cell phone on the desk. I said, the first person that calls me from a payphone will win a certain prize or get a certain accolade. And then they'll say, Mr. Sweet, or Ted, as I like to be called, there are no payphones. And that's something that happened. When payphones were taken out of society, eliminated one of the ways in which a homeless person or someone who's destitute could get in contact with someone. I don't know if anybody ever remember what we call a collect call, but now you don't really have those calls when someone's incarcerated. But, you know, unless you have a cell phone, you're kind of like out of luck. So what I plan on doing is giving individuals a cell phone, calling them in quarterly intervals, you know, every 3 months. And the main call I want to make is a year after that to make sure that these people are still on the planet Earth. And I consider that a victory, because I'm going to be dealing with the most vulnerable populations, which is going to be the homeless population. And one of the, you know, it's not necessarily, I don't want to stigmatize people, but a lot of the homeless individuals will end up having a mental health issue due to the fact that they're going to have episodes where their life might be threatened, where they might have depression and so on and so forth. So basically what I'm trying to do is go out there, touch some veterans, inform them of their benefits, give them a cell phone, be able to contact them, and then hopefully with a lot of the services that VA has already, we can get them off of the streets and not have them be a candidate for taking their own life at some point in time.
Let's talk about field training experience. What does that have to do with what you're doing?
Say that again.
Let's talk about field training experience. You said describe FTX. What is field training experience, and how does that go hand-in-hand with what you're talking about as a profile soldier?
Oh, field training, FTX, field training exercise. Any soldier, especially Army and our little brothers, the Marines, I say that jokingly, but the Army is the oldest service branch. We would go what we call in the field 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, months, where we would do an FTX where we would actually sleep outside, and part of that you would do land navigation where you have to, you know, do certain rally points in which you would, you know, basically it's simulating a war game where you would, you know, you would attack certain people at certain grid coordinates, you know, using your lensatic compass or using GPS nowadays. So so the juxtaposition, or to analogize it, is that I would use my military training in being able to navigate myself through the woods. What I'd be navigating myself through is through the streets and going to places mm-hmm. in which normal people, not normal people, but people probably wouldn't be comfortable with going, alleyways and things of this nature, places where homeless people might congregate to sleep at night and talk to them. And one of the things that makes a veteran kind of like a perfect tool in which to do this particular exercise or do this particular project is we always will say, where you been, where you from, you know, where were you stationed? And there's a lot of codes in the military. We talk in a lot of acronyms and whatnot. And that's just part, and that's actually part of us when we try to transfer to civilian life, they try to eliminate a lot of those acronyms, you know, so that we can become more civilian oriented and matriculate back into the general society. But I would use these field training exercise techniques to go out amongst the cities, St. Louis, Chicago, Houston, Dallas, Las Vegas, Memphis, Chicago, I'll be coming to your city, and going out and talking to the veterans where they're at. And it's almost like I was saying, like a church. You know, sometimes, you know, a person may not come to a church because they didn't have a chance to take a shower. They don't have a nice suit to put on. They don't have slacks or a shirt that's serviceable. So sometimes you got to go outside the church and meet people on the streets and minister to them there with the hope that one day they might be able to join your congregation.
Wow. So let's talk about your goals of the Project 22.
Okay, my goal mm-hmm. is very simple. Everybody that I contact and that I come in contact with, I want them to be alive 12 months later when I talk to them or when I call them on the cell phone or text them on the cell phone. That's basically the win-win project of it. And the thing I was telling you, Janine, no one, you know, to my knowledge, doing this because there's no glamour in doing this. There's no glamour in dealing with the homeless because all you got to do is just ask yourself, what do you do when you see someone and you walk by them and they're begging? Or they're asking, I don't like to use the word beg, but they're asking for some change and so forth. A lot of times people might walk by these people and say, hey, you know, I don't have time to be bothered and so forth. But if you go back to the Bible, it says that, hey, anytime you give to a person or a stranger, that person is basically you're giving to Jesus. That's how, you know, that's how you are to act Christ-like. You're supposed to pray for your enemy. You're supposed to pray for those who doesn't have, you know, some of the blessings that you might have. So my goal simply is, if I go to a city, I'm not going to do an intake like we did in my office, where we would have what we call wraparound services. I know if we got social workers or probation officers and so forth, wraparound services means services from A to Z. You know, I'm not going to be doing that. What I plan on doing is going out, talking to the veteran, informing him of services that are already out there. And once he's in contact with the VA, they need to do their job, and they need to, you know, take care and square away a veteran. Like one of the mottos in the military is, we leave nobody behind. And that should be whether we're in combat or whether we're in
civilian.
A veteran service. The mission continues, I would say, even after service. I don't think it should just come on Veterans and Memorial Day. Like, I don't know if any of you all watch Jeopardy, but here's a question for you. What's the only occupation in the United States of America that gets a holiday? And that's the military. Firefighters. No occupation in the United States of America warrants a holiday other than military service and our veterans. And the reason for that is, if it wasn't for us, our country would be ran by someone else. And if you don't believe that, all you got to do is look at the conflicts that's going on around the world.
You said something earlier about when a veteran enter as a vibrant person. When they exit, they change. Do you think go ahead.
No, I don't want to say this. I'm not speaking for all veterans. I'm just saying that when you enter the military, we have this phrase called gung-ho or hua. That means you're motivated and so on and so forth. You're naive. A lot of times you got to get trained up and so on. And in the military, there is a period of, I don't want to call it brainwashing, but I want to call it confidence building, where you're told that you can do anything, and the word C-A-N apostrophe T is out of your vocabulary. And it's replaced by the word C-A-N. You can do something. You know, cannot is not something that's looked upon favorably. So when individuals get out, if they're a career soldier, they get out. That means they serve 20, 30 years. A lot of them are, I just say this, and I've talked to my father. He knows about this. And a lot of old-timers, and when I say old-timers, these are people in the Vietnam era. There was a point in time when there wasn't nobody having a patch on the right side of their shoulder, and a lot of people don't understand that in the civilian world. But if you have a patch on your right shoulder, that means you've been in combat. And there was a time frame when we were going to be walking around where we weren't going to have anybody that had combat experience in the military. In the military, the whole purpose of the military is to defend this country from attack. That's the purpose of the military, is to prevent or go to war in furtherance of American democracy. That's what the military is about. And we were going to walk around with having nobody in the military that had combat experience, and then we went to the Gulf, then we went to Afghanistan, and so on and so forth. But there was a time frame in the 70s, 80s, 80s and 90s when individuals retired with 20, 25 years, 30 years, and they would end up dying within a year because their life was so structured when they got out of the military. They just could not, and these were individuals that had homes, they had retirement, they had pension pay. They weren't homeless or anything of that nature. It's just that they weren't they were so indoctrinated, I believe, that when they got out, they would just pass away. And this, I don't think this phenomenon is happening anymore, but at one point in time, they had to address that. And they address that because this was happening to command sergeant majors, first sergeants, majors, lieutenant colonels, flag officers, which would be a colonel and above, generals. You know, these individuals would end up, retiring and then dying. But that's not the case no more. But I think a lot has to be done with the transition from military to civilian life. And I think a lot of that needs to be placed on the active duty component of the military, which would be the Department of Defense, not the Department of Veterans Affairs, because you have control over the veteran 24, over the soldier 24/7 when you're in the Department of Defense. When you're in the veteran, everything is voluntary. He doesn't have to show up unless he wants to. So I think that when we do have, you know, when we do have control of our soldiers who's going to matriculate and going to become veterans, I think we need to do better by them, by preparing them for military service afterwards.
Mm.
I mean, preparing them for civilian life afterwards.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to say civilian life. So, Teddy, I know we're getting close to the hour, and I want to say thank you for letting Love Journey be the first place that you'd be interviewed. I'm super excited about your 22-city journey across to inform veterans and to assist our veterans. Is there anything you want our listening audience to know for less, or are you willing to take questions, or you need to go?
No, I can take questions.
Okay, is there anything you want to say before we open up the line?
No, it's just that I would just say, you know, thank you. Just look out for your fellow man. And, you know, a lot of us veterans, you know, when we come out, we become part of the community too. So all we want to do is just be welcomed. You know, we try to do our part in reference to being a vibrant member of the community, and I just hope that we're accepted with open arms.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I want to let you know we have about 175 people on the line, so we're going to try to take as many questions as we can. We have a chat area. If you want to put your question in the chat area, you can just go into Blog Talk Radio and put your question in, or you can press *1 right now and let us know that you have a question. And let me look into the chat. Okay, we have a chat question right now. A young lady says she's been married to a veteran for 10 years, but she said they've been high school sweethearts. But it seemed like the military changed him and made him a mean kind of person, which sometimes translates in his ability to being a father that's mean. I guess that's what she's saying. I guess she's saying that he's mean, and she wants to know how can he get some help, because she feels like his mental health status changed when he went to combat military. And then they were high school sweethearts. She said he was a nice person, and when he got back, he seemed a lot meaner.
I can understand that. First and foremost, mental health is a very touchy subject. I actually did a commercial about it in 2019 for Penn Fed Credit Union. I plan on doing another commercial coming up in July for October's Mental Health Month, by the way. But I would like, you know, you can just give her my telephone number, or give him my telephone number so I can talk to them. But here's the main thing that needs to happen in reference to what they, when they talk about being mean and so forth. The purpose of the military is war. Prevention of war or to fight a war, but it's defense of our country. So a lot of times when we're given instructions during training and so forth, we don't have time for back talk. We have to give instructions in a stern, formal manner, which might involve a little yelling or might involve a little what some people might consider mean, but we consider it, you know, firm. And I understand it. I understand it. In the civilians, a lot of civilians probably would not understand that. But what happens is that my fellow veteran, and I consider all veterans my brothers and sisters, and I know the young lady that put in that call, the person, that husband of hers, I consider him my brother. And what needs to happen is that he needs to go to VA, and he needs to tell someone at VA that he needs help. The difference between a VA hospital and a regular hospital is this. You show your ID, or if you don't have an ID, you give your Social Security number. They can look up that you're a veteran. And all you got to do is utter the words, "I need some help." You don't have to tell them anything else. You know, it's not like you know, your insurance is paid for. It's kind of like it's paid for because you serve your country. Only 6% of the U.S., 6% of the U.S. protects the other 94%. 6% of the United States of Americans protect the other 94%. We're the ones that go to war. We're the ones that keep this country safe. So when you go to a VA hospital, all you got to do is just go in there and tell them you need some help. One of the things that I don't like about the Veterans Affairs intake system, I don't know if they changed it, but when you deal with mental health, they'll have you get in a circle around a table, and you'll have ladies that may have MST, military sexual trauma. You might have some gentlemen with PTSD or some people with bipolar disorder or whatever, and you have to tell everybody about your issue when, you know, in a group setting. I think that's ridiculous. That's how I had to tell people, that's how I had to do my intake in Baltimore. And then they ask you afterwards, do you want to be seen one-on-one? Of course you want to be seen one-on-one, but that's something that should have happened from beforehand. But like everything, it spreads around, and if a veteran has a problem, he's not going to want to be able to tell someone like it's an NA, Narcotics Anonymous, or AA, Alcoholics Anonymous type setting. I think the setting should be private, and it should be, you know, private and very personal. I don't think it should be impersonal in public. I don't think it's something that should be done in a gathering. So that might be a reason why some people don't have,
will ask for support.
I guarantee if these individuals are in Chicago, I know Chicago got a vibrant veteran community, and Chicago got veterans that are willing to help. But I'm in D.C. Just give that individual my number. Give that brother my number. And I guarantee he'll be squared away afterwards. He'll get the help. He'll get the help he needs.
All right. Thank you. She's from Philadelphia, and I'll make sure she gets your information. All right, caller. We have a caller coming up, and your number is 773-234 is 5623. You up. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Could you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I have a question for the gentleman.
Okay. Can you tell him?
We
can't hear you. Can you tell him where you're from, and can you say your name?
Yeah, I'm from Chicago, Illinois.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
And my name is Israel.
Beautiful
name. Yeah, first of all, I want to applaud the brother for what he's doing. I think that what he's doing is very noble, and it's very needed. And the question that I'm going to ask, I hope it doesn't sound like an ignorant question, because I'm really trying to understand the whole suicide situation. And like you mentioned, in the military, they teach you they take the word can't out your vocabulary, so everything is can, like I can overcome anything. So I'm trying to understand where's the breakdown, with the men and women when they come out of the military that would constitute them committing suicide. I mean, you know, the frame of mind of a military person is to overcome obstacles, I guess personal and, you know, outside themselves. So what are some of the causative factors in these young men and women committing suicide?
Beautiful question. It's not an ignorant question, but I'm going to give a juxtaposition or analogy, and I'm going to use boxing because I have a I'm a radio host myself. I have a boxing, mixed martial arts, pro wrestling podcast in Washington, D.C. But I don't know if you heard, I'm going to give you an example of something. Floyd Mayweather was the greatest boxer on earth. Floyd Mayweather's pay-per-views always would sell out. But when Floyd Mayweather had the cameras taken off of him, he ended up doing celebrity boxing where he would box people that he know he could beat easily. The last time he fought, he fought in front of an empty arena, and I don't think he's going to be doing this little, like, farewell tour. So what I'm saying is, in just like the NFL, you know, you play in front of thousands of people, you play in front of millions of people on TV and in arenas, but once the lights go off and you come out of this violent, you come out of that violent type of lifestyle, and then you come into a regular type of lifestyle, you realize that you don't fit in anymore.
Yes, sir.
And so I give you a perfect example. I was a parachutist. I jumped out of planes. I was airborne qualified in the military. That's something that gives you an adrenaline rush like no other. But when you can't do it anymore, when you come out the military and you can't do it anymore and you walk around a civilian and they think like, hey, who's this broken down soldier? And you're saying like, hey, look, I used to be able to do things that few people on earth would be able to do. You'll go into a depression because the only way that you could get back into that lifestyle is to go back into the military, which you cannot go back into. So what we have to do in the military is we got to be able to decompress and help our military brothers and sisters matriculate into the civilian world. It's just like, I don't know if you watch sports, but you know you come from a great city with Chicago Bulls and the Bears and whatnot, but about 85% of pro athletes are broke after 6 years of being outside of their sport. These are millionaires.
Yes.
So what happened is, and the reason for that is this. I'm going to tell you the reason economically. They had a spending habits of, like, let's say $1 million a year. They got $6 million in the bank. They spend $6 million in 6 years. Then afterwards, they don't have that big-time contract coming back in. So a lot of times they're broke or they're working at regular jobs and whatnot. That happens. And the thing about the military is this. It's one of the few places where you can walk around and you can shoot weapons which are only meant to be on the battlefield. And then you come home and you can tell people, and sometimes people like to call it war stories, I did this, I did this, I did this, and I did this. But unless you're talking to an audience of people who know what you're talking about, a lot of your accolades are not going to mean anything other than to people that were similarly situated. Like I'm sitting here saying this. I'll give you a perfect example, my friend. I got out of the military in 1994. My father was in the military for 30 years. I went to college and law school, but it took me 17 years before I applied for benefits. And the military made me that way. I would have to wait in the metro for hours and hours and hours because I was waiting for a train that didn't have too many people in it because I was claustrophobic. Or else I have to wait for people to come to the elevator and say, hey, can I ride up with you, and so on and so forth. You know, a lot of the wounds that some of these individuals carry around you know, you can see someone with a prosthetic, but, you know, some of these other wounds, you know, you may not see. But I give you a perfect example. I saw a man's arm get blowed off in Fort Drum, New York, because a lieutenant was priming dynamite with deck, you know, he was using timing fuse and deck cord. Timing fuse goes off real slow. Deck cord goes off fast. He primed it with the wrong prime, meaning the wrong type of wick, if you want to use a candle type juxtaposition, and the sergeant first class arm got blowed off due to the fact that the dynamite was primed wrong. And when you can't unsee something, but what happens is that when situations like that happen, you gotta drive on. Like when I was in Erzurum, Turkey, when I got locked in the arms room, I got locked in the vault. That's one of the reasons I'm claustrophobic. When I came out, you know, the first thing we was on a detachment in Erzurum, Turkey. They just basically said, "Hey, sweet, get a shot of Johnny Walker." That's what happened.
Wow.
Mm. So, but my friend, your question was a beautiful question. There was nothing ignorant about it, because what you're basically saying is like, how can someone end up doing something like that? I mean, committing suicide when at one point in time they were squared away. And I would say this, that's where the mental health component needs to come in. Mental health needs to be something that needs to be discussed like we're talking right now. It doesn't need to be discussed with whispers and behind closed doors. And I want to say this right now. Everybody on planet Earth that's walking with two legs has some kind of mental health issue. It may not be diagnosed or whatever, but when you get mad, you know, you're changing your mental health psyche. And so I think the more it becomes normalized, I think the less issues we'll see.
Yes, sir.
Mm. Wow.
But now your question was a beautiful question, though. I really appreciate it, Israel.
All right, thank you very much, my brother, and, you know, keep up the good work, man. I really applaud, you know, what you're doing. You know, I think it's very noble and it's very needed.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Wow. Okay, so thank you, Israel, for your question. Next, we have 773-7716. That's 7716 is the last four. You're on.
Good evening. Good
Hello.
Evening. Hi.
Good evening.
This is my aunt. I'm from Chicago. And first I want to just, you know, commend you for your service. And also my dad was a veteran. He was in the Air Force. He was in the Vietnam, was part of Vietnam. So at that time, you know, Air Force men could not, black men could not fly the planes. That was his, you know, hope. But he wasn't able to do that. And so I do commend you for your work. So I do have a question, though. What is the likened to when men or women are in prison and there should be some form of a transition when they're coming out, transition, you know, back to the quote unquote
civilian
real world, civilian life? Is there some form of transition program or transitionary period? If someone knows, okay, I will be, you know, leaving whatever service I'm in a year, and in that year, taking classes on, you know, mental health classes, you know, how to calm your mind, how to, you know, when these triggers happen, how to, you know, deal with things differently than how you might deal with them in the service. Is there anything like that?
No, there is, and that's a beautiful question, ma'am. The current Secretary of Defense is a black man by the name of Lloyd Austin. He was a four-star general before he was the Secretary of Defense, and he has some mandates on basically transitioning from soldier to civilian. I know when I got out, they had, you know, a little, you know, they didn't have as much as they do now. But one of the things I think that you hit on, and I think it should be taken up by, you know, our Congress, and hopefully we will see some movement there. As I said before, when you have the uniform, you can be told to do anything as long as it's an official order and it doesn't hurt you, your life isn't threatened by doing it and so forth, and you're not breaking any laws. Once you become a veteran, everything is voluntary. So, I know you probably was listening to what I was saying earlier. There should be a transition program. There is a transition program, but I think that it needs to be implemented almost as much as we do PT. PT, we do 5 days a week, call cadence, exercise, push-ups, sit-ups, run, among other things. And I think that when a person becomes a short-timer, they need to transition, they need to go ahead. And what I would say they need to do is they need to be in their own company. Let me tell you the reason why I'm saying this. You got like 150 people in a company, 150 people to 300 people. In a country, a company has four platoons. That's the smallest element of a military unit. You got company, battalion, brigade, division, army, and it goes up, and each one is commanded by a higher level officer. But what happens is that if you're in a unit like in Fort Bragg, 82nd Airborne, 10th Mountain Division in Fort Drum, 101st Airborne Division, Fort Campbell, Kentucky, 7th Special Forces Group in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, you have all these units which require you to be almost like elite athlete ready, and then you got someone that's transitioning out the military. They're not going to be as gung-ho. They're not going to be as sharp as these individuals that got 5 years left on their military contract or 3 years left. You only have 30 days or you only have 2 months. You shouldn't be amongst them because you operate as a unit and you're only as good as your weakest link. And they're not trying to be weak. What's happening is this person is trying to say, hey, look, I might want to be a manager at Walmart instead of being a platoon sergeant for 2nd Platoon, working at the motor pool or whatever. So I would suggest that these individuals go into their own company, and that's something that's going to be talked about, like at TRADOC, Training and Doctrine Command. But I think the soldiers need to be kind of like separated in reference to active soldiers that are deployable and then soldiers that aren't deployable, because you're not going to be deployed if you're short. Short means you only got a certain amount of time left in the military. And short timers should be separated from people that have a lot of time left in the military because their motives, their mission, personal motives and personal missions are very different, which don't go with the unit's mission. But no, that's a beautiful question. But there is transition programs, but I think they just need to be separated.
How effective are they? Because the amount of people that come out with the PTSD and, you know, the mental health issues, understanding that the job that they've been doing would, you know, could leave them like this because it's, I mean,
well,
just
okay,
watching.
Let me say something real quick. I want to get something clear for the listening public. Not every veteran that comes out has this issue. A lot of them don't. But this is the reason I'm on this phone. This is the reason I'm on this radio show. I don't want there to be one person like that.
Yeah.
I don't want there to be one person like that. So it's a minority of individuals. It's less, you know, it's not an overwhelming number. But the thing about it is it should not be any number. So when individuals come out of the military, it's almost like you want to be proud of yourself. Sometimes you don't want to ask for help, but sometimes you need to ask for help. But I think things are changing, and one of the things that's changing, ma'am, is that COVID-19 showed the United States of America, it showed the world that mental health is an issue. Because a lot of people, you know, were affected mentally by COVID-19. You know, cabin fever. Seeing individuals or seeing reports of so many people dying. You know, panic attacks, anxiety. You know, one of the number one things that went up in healthcare was individuals that wanted health, mental health counselors of any kind, psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health counselors and whatnot. So the reason I talk about that is that if we see that it's an issue in the non-military world, the civilian world, then individuals will understand what we go through in the military. So I see you should see some efforts going in on that. But there's an old phrase, and it talks about government. It says change in the government never comes from within the government. It always comes from outside the government. Think about what I just said. Change from the government never comes from within the government. It comes from outside the government. So individuals like yourself, you know, you just made a phone call, but somebody might hear that phone call and they might hear this conversation and they might take it up, you know. So I appreciate you for asking that question on behalf of your father. God bless him and God bless his service and other individuals that are nameless. You know, nameless in meaning we don't know their name, but they served. But change will come because of what you just said, because I'm talking about it, Janine's talking about it, and a lot of people are hearing about it. And if you never wore boots before, understand that something like that needs to be done. And you're caring enough to call, you know, from the great city of Chicago at this point in time in night, I think individuals should probably pay heed to it.
All right.
Thank you. Is there anything we can do outside their paperwork or any type of flyers or things that we can pass out to, you know, people on the street just to bring awareness? Like, is there anything that we could do?
No, you're doing this, but I want to sit here and say something. One of the things you can do is you can vote. You can vote. You guys got good senators. You got Duckworth. You got Durbin. You know, you got – a lot of times change will come through laws. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. We just had the PACT Act, which basically states that individuals that were stationed in Vietnam – in certain other conflict areas, instead of them having to prove that they were working with toxic chemicals and so forth and so on. All they got to do is just have orders that stated they were in country, and they get the benefit instead of them having to grovel and beg and try to prove, you know, something that's hard that you can't prove because you weren't even thinking of trying to collect evidence of your injury while you were in the military. So the PACT Act, that came about by individuals like Jon Stewart, the comedian activist from The Daily Show, you know, advocating for people. So I think one of the main things you can do is like say, hey, you know, Congressman, hey, Senator, what's your position on this veteran issue? And if you want to keep your job in Washington, D.C., where I live, you need to pay attention and you need to make sure that this happens. That's kind of like how, that's how you can really help. Because sometimes these politicians, they don't understand anything except whether or not they're a politician the next day holding elected office.
Wow. Thank you, Maya. Were you complete?
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, we're going to go to the next caller. Your number is 773-2980. Your last four is 2980. Thank you again, Maya.
Good evening.
You on the air? Okay.
Good evening. I wanted to say thank you for your information. Thank you for your service. I have a question. I'm from Chicago, and I'm piggybacking off of the previous caller. In that in Chicago, there are a lot of veterans who are having trouble, like the young lady said before, in getting their services. And I wanted to know, I guess you answered it partially, but why is it that the government, realizing the rigor that they put the veterans through to be a military person, that they do not recognize that some of them come away from the wars and the things they've seen not being able to be within the regular civilization or the regular population as civilians? Why is there a disparity between VA offices in one state or another? And is the fund adequately dispersed from the White House to ensure that the services that those agencies should have are equal? I guess I'll say that.
It's a beautiful question. You had me smiling while you were saying that. All you got to do, ma'am, I just say this. Sometimes the ethnic makeup of different cities, of different states, are different. And what I will say is this: the military is supposed to be colorblind. And I can say that it's one of the few places where you can see an African American in charge ordering other people to do things. I could say that. But at the same point in time, does racism exist in the military? Of course it does. And does that matriculate out into the veterans' affairs? Of course it does. Because from, you know, just look at it. What's the biggest government agency in the government? It's the Department of Defense. What's the second biggest? It's the Department of Veterans Affairs. They're first cousins. So I'll give you an example of kind of like touching on the question. I had flat feet when I came into the military, mild flat feet. And I have a case that's coming up before the Board of Veterans Appeals on the 15th, and I'm arguing myself, basically saying that the military caused my feet to become worse over time frame. I didn't complain when I was in the military like a lot of other people. because one, I had a father who was a 30-year command sergeant major, so they say, well, sweet, you come from a hard family, so you shouldn't be complaining, and I bought into that. But at the same point in time, you know, I've been denied, you know, service, you know, compensation, service connection because of that. But what I do in Profile Soldier is I go and I get medical treatises and scientific journals. There was an article that I found from the New England Journal of Medicine that which basically states that individuals that have rucksacks on their back, their feet will become more flattened because of that basic load, especially the heavier the rucksack and the longer you had to walk. So instead of me having to prove that I had went to the doctor on such and such a date, all I got to do is just prove that I was in that particular unit, which is Fort Drum, New York, and we, you know, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to call a little cadence. And cadence is what we used to use. It's kind of like a rhythmic song that we would use when we're running. And one of the lines is, I used to drive a Cadillac, now I march it on my back. And what that basically says is that everything that you put in your trunk of your car back in the day when you were on the block or on the streets as a civilian, now you carry on your back because you're now the Cadillac. And, you know, individuals that are in the military or who serve, I know they heard that cadence many times when they were marching on road marches or during PT. So what I try to do in a service I provide in Profile Soldier is, you know, there's the mental health component part of it, but there's a legal part of it too, because when my case is won and I'm going to win my case, that case will become public notice. And so other soldiers who may not have complained or may not have certain records available because they didn't go to sit call, they can use the same strategy that I use, basically saying that, hey, look, you know I had a rucksack on my back because you issued me a rucksack. I got pictures of myself marching. You know I march. They understand. They know everything that's going on, and they would be able to get their benefits in these alternative modes. But like I said, there's a thing in military called MEPS. Before you go in, it's called your pre-physical, which basically says, you know, are you good enough to come into the military? Because some people, you know, are excluded because they may have heart murmurs or anything of that, some things of that, those natures. But if you're in the military and you come in, there's a doctrine called the presumption of soundness. That means that you're sound mind and body. You are ready to go. You should be able to soldier, either Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and you're good to go. So if you come out and you're anything less than, you can probably attribute it to your military service, and that includes mental health. And one of the reasons is a beautiful question that caller had. One of the reasons why mental health is so hard to get service connected for, but it's changing, is because it's a taboo topic. Taboo meaning people don't like to talk about it. So if people don't like to talk about it, how are you going to get service connected? Because when they inspect you, they're going to want to see complaints, they're going to see letters, they're going to see proof that you have that condition and that you're not doing what we call in the military called malingering. Meaning you're acting like you're sick or you're acting like you have a condition, but you really don't. So, but the caller is basically helping soldiers, and I want you to be aware of this, because what we didn't have 30 years ago, what we didn't have was social media. We had telephone booths where we could make a call, but we don't have that no more. But we do have social media. Somebody that knows somebody will hear this and they understand, hey, what she said made too much sense. Why don't we implement it? So thank you for that.
All right. Thank you, Paula. Thank you so much for that question. Were you complete?
Well, in my, I do have one follow-up that occurred to me while he was speaking. And I somewhat know the answer, but I want your perspective. And again,
yes,
I appreciate you for your service. And I commend all veterans for protecting this country against all evils around the world. So I really, really appreciate you. But my second question is from a male person's perspective. If we were ever to be in war again or need soldiers again, with the climate of things that are going on with the veterans that we're trying to take care of now and get services for now, how does the White House feel they're going to have people enlist when those that we have now are not being taken care of? I mean, I don't understand. I don't want to see a war, but I don't understand how they think people would volunteer when the promise is that they will come back and be taken care of, and then the reality is
you are my sister, because I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. Let me tell you the two hardest jobs in the military. I'm going to tell you the second hardest, and then I'm going to tell you the first hardest. The hardest, I should say. The second is a drill sergeant. That's the one who trains soldiers who come into the military. But you know what the hardest job in the military is? Is a recruiter. That's someone who's talking to these high school seniors, or talking to anybody under the age of, I think, 34, where you can come in. That's the hardest job in the military. But they got incentives now to come into the military, such as, you know, they're giving out, the incentives are good. You know, they're giving out cash bonuses. They're giving out educational bonuses. The GI Bill has been revamped. But at the same point in time, I hear what you're saying, because you got to do better by your veterans than you do, because otherwise, why would someone want to go in and become a veteran themselves? But let me give you an analogy, and I love your question, because a lot of times you're not biased because you're not a veteran. So I love hearing that from you. But here's the issue. Like the NFL, if you look at the NFL and you look at the contracts have exploded. These men are making almost, you know, a fifth of $1 billion, you know, for certain positions and so forth. The salaries have exploded. But then you see CTE and you see concussion protocol and you see some of these individuals like Tony Dorsett and Earl Campbell. If any of you all are football fans, you'll know who I'm talking about. Great running backs for the Houston Oilers and Dallas Cowboys. Some of these men are penniless. And you're not going to do good, but if you're going to have a Hall of Fame or anything else where you're going to honor, you know, those who came before you, you need to do well by your veterans. What they did this past year, we got the largest increase in our veterans benefits that we did in about 40 years. They increased us about 8%, but that's barely caught up with what the inflation is. No, but what I say is this: until all veterans don't have to struggle through getting these benefits, one of the side effects, or one of the takeaways, or one of the casualties of it is our military may not be as strong as it used to be. And I come, like I said, I was born, since I've been born to this second, I've been part of the military. I was a dependent with my from 1 to 18. Then I joined the military as active duty, and now I'm a veteran. So I've always been connected to the military, and I hate to say it, and I don't want, you know, and I think I know we're the strongest military in the world. So they need to do better by us. Watch, if you watch the Super Bowl, they always show our strength by having that military flyover. We own the B-2 bomber, the most sophisticated warplane in the history of man. We can defeat anybody. But if we want to keep that reputation up, we need to do well by people who came before us. But I totally agree.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to next. We got quite a few people, and we're going to try to get as many as we can. Thank you for that question. You always bring great perspectives. I love you, love you, love you. All right, great. We're going to go on to 504, last one, 2081. Thank you for tuning in. You on the air?
I just wanted to, first of all, thank Janine for the platform and for just your transparency and the strength of the work that you are still doing, even off the front lines. Like, it's just so commendable for myself. Just the veterans are so neglected, and we can see that in our homeless population here in America, and even those that are housed, just what being on the warp front has done in terms of their capacity, or just things that are inarticulate in terms of the type of environments that they've been exposed to that are just out of the norm of everyday civil, you know, engagement. So this need and this advocacy is so important, and definitely will be, I know for myself, I'll be following whatever platforms you might have to see if there's ways that we can partner to bring greater voice to the work that you're doing, because our community, of course, as you know, which is why you're doing the work, is in such dire a need of this type of advocacy. So I just wanted to say I appreciate your story, your testimony, your journey, and your commitment. And the mission that you have taken on outside of the work that you have been assigned to on the battlefield. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and just say thank you so much for bringing voice and being available for this conversation.
No, thank you, ma'am. That means a lot to me. I honestly say that. Because sometimes you wonder if certain people care or not, because a lot of times when you do your work, you know, I don't do my work for fanfare or for self-aggrandizement and whatnot. I do it because I could easily be in that situation and I would want someone to help me. So when I'm helping these individuals, it's not out of self-pity or anything of this nature. It's because they earned it. And, you know, we got to get back to being, you know, good Americans, good citizens, good Christians and whatnot. And what you said just now, ma'am, is, you know, I'm going to wear it as proudly as I wore ribbons that I were awarded when I was in the military, because it means something when it comes from the people. And I thank you, and just please pray for us, pray for our country, pray for our veterans.
Thank you, and thank you, Janine, for this. This has richly, richly encouraged me for the work that we do in community. So knowing that he's there, it definitely has fortified us. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you for the work that you do as well, being a community activist, collaborating with so many partnerships with me. I appreciate you for being here, and I appreciate you too. Thank you for your comments. All right, we got 773-9211. You are up. 773-9211.
Good evening. This is me. Good evening. This is Dion. Hey, Janine, thank you so much for inviting me. Mrs. Teddy, I want to thank you for your service. You dropped some true knowledge for myself tonight. As far as something, it's quite a few things that you said that were really impactful. One, you said 94% are protected by 6% of the armed forces, and that's I don't want to take that for granted. and up until tonight, hearing exactly what they're going through, because I too am from Chicago, and I do see our homeless population, and I do know that our homeless population is largely veteran. It's mind-blowing, and I'm grateful. So thank you so much for your service, and thank you for your continued service also. But there was a couple things that you said that I wanted to – there's a couple questions that I had. I heard you say that all armed – anyone that has ever served in the military, you consider your brother and sister. And I could just – I would imagine, maybe I could be wrong, that the majority of them – also feel that same call as far as that you all are united in your service and your and the purpose of your service. With that one understanding, my question is there a call to action? And what I mean by that is I heard you also say that sometimes because they're so indoctrinated to the military way of life when they come out, they have trouble fully transitioning back into civilian life. Is there a kind of like a, I don't want to say a cat call, but is there like a large call that can be made to all veterans that can maybe gather everyone to make an announcement to some sort, if that makes any sense how I'm saying that?
No, it makes beautiful sense. I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm gonna say a quick story about wrestling because it relates to suicide. And basically it involves a family called the Von Erich family. They were wrestling. They were a famous wrestling family that had six brothers. Five of the brothers died, most of them from suicide. And so when Kevin Von Erich, the lone brother who was surviving, when he was inducted into the Wrestling Hall of Fame, he started to speak about his brothers, and a hush came over the audience due to the fact that he was so close-lipped about it, and he talked, and he basically said these words. He said, after a death in our family, the first month or two, he said, you would get a lot of meals, you would get a lot of phone calls and so forth and so on. But then he said the hardest part was 3 months later when all the food, when all the calls wouldn't come, then you had to sit with the fact that your brother committed suicide. And this family almost had an iniquity put on it, a curse. Five times that happened. So what I'm saying is, a lot of times in Veterans Day, Memorial Day, we will go on we'll have our day of vacation, we'll have our holiday and so on and so forth. You know, us veterans, we'll be able to go Golden Corral or whatever restaurant and get a free meal if we want to decide to take it. And then after that, it goes away. I think we didn't serve for one day. So I think it should be something that should be done every day. I'm not saying get food every day. That's not what I'm talking about. But until someone, makes this advocacy part of their political legacy, I'm talking about lawmakers and whatnot, I don't see how there's going to be any change. And the funny thing about it, and you have a beautiful question, if you ever watched the State of the Union address where the President of the United States addressed the country, where the whole House and the whole Senate are being in chambers, the only time everybody stands up is when they talk about veterans. So it's something they both agree on, but they're not doing anything about. So I think the only way in which really certain things can happen is that it's got to happen from the outside. And what I mean by that is this. I don't work for the Department of Veteran Affairs in no way, shape, or form. So they're not employing me. They're not doing anything for me. But a Department of Veterans Affairs employee cannot be on the telephone with Janine Ingram tonight talking, because they lose their job in a second. Because anytime anything negative or controversial might be said, and I'm not saying controversial, just saying true, they lose their job. So the only way change is going to come is by someone having being active in advocacy, and that's what I'm doing, and I'm not the only one. I'm not going to sit here and martyr myself. But I appreciate phone calls such as yours that intelligently and emotionally articulates the topic that they should be doing more for us. Because, like I said, they are my brothers and sisters.
All right.
So that actually piggybacked me, throws me into my next question. It's going to be fast. I hope it's going to be fast.
Not a problem.
Is there something like an expo? Not that you're doing enough. I mean, not that you're not doing enough, but could there be an expo? Because I personally know of one of my good girlfriends has a veterans not-for-profit organization, but because she's starting out, I don't know if there, I don't know, because it's not necessarily my wheelhouse. But is there like a platform for veterans? I heard you say before that you were going to get all veterans cell phones that you're able to put your hands on. But is there a platform somewhat that they have access to that can teach them about the financial literacy, that can teach them about financial literacy and sustainability and accessing the resources that they have, and even addressing their whatever their mental issue is? Because I heard you say that when they first do the intake, everybody is in a Narcotic Anonymous room, kind of, and everybody has to expose their truth in front of everyone else.
It's a beautiful question, but it's kind of like what Janine was telling you before about a field training exercise. I know of many, 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 many veteran programs that teach financial literacy, credit rebuilding, savings, and so on and so forth, of all types of all disciplines. The difference is this: getting the veteran connected with that. Getting the veteran connected with that. And I just want to put you all in a position. Just think about this. Think about if you haven't showered in about a couple of weeks. You don't have anything to eat. You don't got no money in your pocket. Are you going to be thinking about going into a place, you know, looking for some of these classes? You're not going to do that. That's the reason why I say we have to go out to them. You got to go out to someone that, for the most part, is ostracized by the general public and say, hey, brother, how you doing? And talk to that person in a humane way. It's almost like church. I give that as a good analogy of juxtaposition. You know, churches say anybody should come in and whatnot. But if you're wearing your Sunday best, which there's nothing wrong with wearing your Sunday best and so forth, but if someone's wearing their Sunday best and then all of a sudden someone comes in, they should be greeted with open arms, but a lot of times they're not. And a lot of times individuals will feel too embarrassed or feel too inadequate to go there. So, like I said, I don't have any problem in doing it, you know. I don't have any problem going out and helping my brothers and whatnot. And I just hope that the little bit I do, it could be emulated by others, you know, and help solve this issue. But instead of complaining about it, I'm trying to do something about it.
Wow. Yes, yes. All right. Thank you, Dee, for your questions. Thank you so much.
All right, we're just going to take one more. We got a lot of people in the queue. I promised him it wouldn't go over an hour, and we in the second hour. So I'm going to take this last person.
I'm good. No, I'm good.
You good? Okay. Okay. All right.
Hey, I am Rosa J.
From Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
sweet
God, sweet, that's me. And I want to say thank you, Janine, for doing Love Journey. It's been a long time since we've been here. I hear all the specials, and I want to say thank you for attending.
Well, you know, special people can get me to do special things. Teddy is special, so he got me on to do this tonight.
I'm so grateful. And, Teddy, I want to commend you. There are a lot of people like yourself here in Washington, the DMV. I have a girlfriend, a couple of them really, Tiffany Daniels. She does a show every Sunday. I wanted to ask you if you would be willing to, if I sent it out to her, have that conversation with her. And then there's the Jackie Iverson, who does amazing things with veterans. I commend you because almost every man in my family was in the veteran, in some sort of officer at a time. And everything that everyone asked and said, it's true, because the military changes you. You know, I can't even begin to imagine what you've encountered, what my father did when he was born in the Korean War. My cousin in the Vietnam, my uncle's in the Vietnam. It's hard to be a soldier. I'm amazed that you come back even in any kind of humanity, because some of the things that you have seen, you never can forget, except for if you ask God. So I am a minister. So I think God is always a tremendous help in healing all things that are wrong with you. And you, sir, are doing amazing things because you are so right. You have to meet people where they are and not expect them to pick up a newspaper or take down a number or even tune into a show like this to get any information to help. So I see great things in your future. I see you helping thousands of vets. And if you particularly male vets, because the men who come back are fathers. You know, they're going to be husbands if they're not already. They are supporters of their family. And how can you support your family if you are not at your top physical and mental state? So, yes, we need all of you to attend, speak about, have a conversation with. And I know when I go down to out in D.C., we have a lot of homeless people on the street. And I would just probably assume or guarantee that a lot of them are dead. And they have these other problems because once a time when you have a mental problem, you usually try to get out of it by something outside of yourself. You know, so a lot of our vets are alcoholics, drug abusers, you know, confused. And people do, but just pass them by. You know, but we're supposed to respect and love our brothers and sisters in whatever condition they are in. And it's good that you go where they are, because they won't come where you are or where we are. But I remember when the sister came into our church, she was dirty, living on the street. And folks looked at her like she was crazy. I walked up to her and said, "Can we help you? Come on in. Enjoy yourself. What can we do?" You know. And when she said her story, I was the only one that said, "Let's do something about this." And I did. So we as individuals, if we want a better place, we have to be a better place. We have to be that love that we want to show. We have to be that gentleman. We have to open up and give what we can, when we can, and how we can, and know that we're doing God's work. So I commend you, Mr. Petty, and may you have many blessings. And I want to give your number to Jackie and Tiffany, because they do shows, they do broadcast, and I would, they will probably reach out to you. So I'm sure Janine is going to ask you for that information.
No, I appreciate
I'm gonna let her,
it.
Yeah, I'm going to let her be your co-host. Well, I appreciate you. I do. And perhaps before you go on your journey, get me to have lunch and talk about it. So give me a call.
No,
I'll
be
Janine has my number. And give me your number. I know you're going to give it in. Do you have any information that we may get in touch with? So thank you. And again, namaste. I see that. Be blessed.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Janine?
Did you hear the question?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. The question is, my father was a military man for over 30 years. He used to take me in the basement and beat me. Is there any services for the trauma I experienced from the hands of a military service person?
Is a caller on the line?
He's a caller. He's in the chat.
Oh, okay. Say that question one more time.
He's saying in the chat that his father used to take him in the basement, hang him from his hands, and beat him a lot. And he's saying that he's experienced trauma at the hand of his father. Is there any services for anybody whose parent, and they experienced trauma from their parent from the military? Are there any services for the children who have trauma from a military experience from their father? Do you get what he's saying?
Yeah, I get it.
He's saying he experienced. Oh, okay.
Nah, what you can do is that, Janine, give him my number. Take
okay.
his information. Take his information and give him my number. But let me just say this. Just to the general audience, military is a tough occupation. You volunteer for it, where other individuals, like my father, they were actually drafted. You know, there's a beautiful show called The Great Team, which talks about a man military. Military man who kind of like abuse his family and whatnot. And if you watch that movie, you could just basically see that his indoctrination did not, it kind of like manifests throughout his whole life. And a lot of times that's what happens when you're in the military. That's something that would be done on a more personal level, where you can talk to probably fellow military brats and so forth, and, you know, we can help each other in that. But the VA doesn't cover that because it doesn't involve the veteran directly.
Okay. All right, Pearl, we got Pearl back in the queue, and then we end because the whole show is ended. So we're going to go with Pearl, and then we're going to turn it back over to you, Teddy.
I think that I wanted to specify how gardening, so we have a community garden, and we've been facilitating workshops and things with veterans to be able to create spaces in regards to the one question about a call of action, and then hearing and about the trauma and the violence that this man experienced. I was curious, one, about ways, I'm going to be following the work, are there ways that they are creating facilitations for PTSD, and are there interventions for families that will be dealing with returned veterans from war to be able to help the family cope with whatever emotional sort of instability or adjustments that are needed to be made? Because that lies so much on our government, and I know that that is just negligent, but do you see any calls to action to help facilitate transitions for veterans to be able to assimilate into the regular normal regimens of everyday life? And again, I want to specify, I don't know if gardenings are being used, but there is a connection between PTSD and how the soil can help to administer a place of healing for gardeners, even with what's in the soil composite. And that's all, and thank you.
No, I think gardening is a beautiful way to minister and to help with a veteran's mental condition. I think, you know, it brings forth one of the needed requirements for life, which is food. So I don't see anything. I definitely see that as being a connection. I was going to say something to you on a legal parameter about veterans, where it helps the veteran, but it also can hurt the family. Not hurt the family, but can ostracize the family. When the individual's in the military will take care of the dependent children, the spouses, and the soldier, of course. But when you get out, you got to be connected to the veteran, and you're not compensated unless you're a child dependent or if you're a spouse. The veteran will get compensation for that. And as far as services, it's, you know, you can get VA health care. There's TRICARE that you can purchase with nominal amount of money, where it can help with health insurance and so on. But one of the things that they put in place is advocacy for the veteran. Like, let's say if the veteran is divorced or so on and so forth. VA funds are non-taxable, and they can't be addressed in certain ways in which alimony or alimony suits would come into play. And that's to help the veteran. In other words, that money is protected, and it goes to the veteran and only for the veteran.
Okay.
But as far as transition programs, yes, there are transition programs. And I think that the bulk of that transition needs to be done while the veteran is a service member, while he's on active duty. You know, they got bigger budgets and they can do more. Because I just say this, and just look at this, just think about this. When you're in the military, you have to do certain things. You have to do certain things. That's just how the military is constructed. You have to do certain things. Like, give you a perfect example, you have to wait in long lines. I know a lot of veterans, I'm one of them, I don't like waiting in lines, not long lines, because I waited in mile-long lines before. But we're not going to do that when we get out, and we're not going to do other similar things when we get out. So while we're in and while we're indoctrinated, while you got our attention 24/7, I think that's where some of this assimilation into the civilian workforce and the civilian culture needs to take place, because you can't build, and it just goes to show, if you're going to build a fighting machine, you got to be able to tone down that fighting machine and make it more suitable for a different mission, I should say. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with what we do in the military. It's just that we should be given the opportunity and given resources to matriculate into the civilian workforce a little easier. And I think the mental health has to be taken into account, because, you know, you get points. You know, you get, if, let's say you go on a job board like USA Jobs, you can go ahead and you can do things. You can get points for that. You get points, I think, from your local government workforces if you happen to be a veteran. But in reference to mental health, that's something that is looked upon, even in today's time, it's looked upon a little with taboo-type eyes, but I think it needs to come more to the forefront. And that's exactly the terminology I used in the commercial I did in 2019 for mental health, Mom. But yes, there needs to be more done, but I think it needs to be done on the active duty front as far as transitioning us meaning veterans, into the population.
All right, Teddy, I just want to say thank you, and more thank yous. You know, we passed the second hour, so I don't want to go too much further. We ended the recording, so if there's anything you want to let your listening audience know, let's do it. And I just want to say thank you for bringing awareness. Thank you for being the person to have the courage to stand up and say yes. It only takes one person to make a difference. And yes, we can make a difference in the world. Thank you, Teddy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate my brothers and sisters. I consider everybody on the phone, my brother and sister, under God's family. Thank you, Windy City, you know, for holding me down this last 2 hours. You made me feel good. I knew I was going to be received well. I didn't know I was going to be received this well. Thank you. God bless you. And, you know, you're helping yourself, you're helping each other, because everybody knows somebody that's a veteran or whatnot. We're all family. And, you know, with how divided the world can be, that's, like I said before, this is something that both political parties are in union with. And I think it's something that we could probably come together on a little better than some of these other topics. So thank you. God bless you. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Oh, wow. Thank you again, Teddy. I just want to thank you for standing up and having the courage. I want to remind each and every one of us that you are a gift from God, and what you do with your life is a gift back to God. I want to remind you in my grandmother's words to choose love. Love is the only choice. She said you ain't been loved till you've been loved by you. She said for every ill, love is the answer.
So I just want to remind you, choose love today. Thank you. And I see you on the next episode of The Love Journey. This is Janine and Ingram, your love experience. And this is Kim. Y'all know, everybody know I love me some Kim. All right, have a good night, you all.
Divine. Come find.